This is the last day of this April 2012 7-day session. And we're going to take up a koan today. This is from the collection of koans known as the Blue Cliff Record. It's number 11. Huang Bo's Mash Eaters. Huang Bo, this is, of course, a Chinese master. His Japanized name is Obaku. But because the original Chinese version is not so hard to pronounce, I'll stick with the Chinese. Huang Bo, instructing the assembly, said, "You are all mash eaters. However you go about traveling on pilgrimages, what is your position today? Do you know that in all the land of Tang there is no Zen teacher?" At that time a monk came forward and said, "But surely there are those who teach disciples and lead communities. What about that?" Huang Bo said, "I do not say that there's no Zen. It's just that there are no Zen teachers." It's been a couple years since I read the biographical material for this great, illustrious Chan master, Huang Bo. He goes back so far that we don't have a birth year for him, but he died in 850, which places him squarely in the great Tang dynasty, along with Yunmen and Zhao Zhou and a lot of others. We'll be reading here from a book called Zen's Chinese Heritage, translated by Andy Ferguson. Well, it gives a bunch of information about where he's born, the province he's born in, where he traveled, and so forth. But I'll just start with his physical appearance. It reads here, "Huang Bo's physical appearance was striking. He had a large, protruding forehead that was whimsically described as a large pearl. He was also supposedly 7 feet tall." This forehead feature of his was described somewhere else as a gem-like boss in his forehead. It's kind of a raised thing in his forehead. Just passing it on. I don't know what that would be exactly. Actually, there is somewhere, I'm just remembering, there's somewhere a famous incident. Actually, we'll get to it. We're reading that. It's a dialogue that we're going to be reading. One of the most famous legends involving Huang Bo was when he was on his way to a certain Buddhist center, Tiantai. Huang Bo met another monk. I'm reading here from the original, the translation from the original Chinese. "They talked and laughed just as though they were old friends who had long known one another. Their eyes gleamed with delight as they then set off traveling together. Coming to the fast rapids of a stream, they removed their hats and took up staffs to walk across. The other monk tried to lead Huang Bo across, saying, 'Come on, come on.' Huang Bo said, If elder brother wants to go across, then go ahead. Then the other monk began walking along on the top of the water, just as though it were dry land. The monk turned to Huangbo and said, "Come on, come on." Huangbo yelled, "Ah, you self-saving fellow. If I had known this before, I would have chopped off your legs." The monk cried out, "Ah, you're truly a vessel of the Mahayana. I can't compare with you." And upon saying that, he vanished. The editor and translator, Andy Ferguson, interprets this as a kind of a metaphor for the teaching of the Mahayana, which is the bodhisattva ideal to defer your own ultimate enlightenment until all beings have been liberated. And the fact that, I guess the idea is that this monk, the fact that he just went off ahead without Huangbo, showed him as not quite up to the true Mahayana. Here's the one about that relates to the forehead of Huangbo. He was at a certain temple, and he was doing prostrations. At that time, the future emperor, Tang Shuangzong, was serving as a novice monk in the temple. Imagine that. The heir apparent, the son of the emperor, doing a stint in a Zen temple, as a novice monk. And this novice monk, future emperor, asked Huangbo, "Not seeking Buddha, not seeking Dharma, not seeking Sangha. When the master bows, what is it you're seeking?" Huangbo said, "Not seeking Buddha, not seeking Dharma, not seeking Sangha. One always bows in just this manner." The novice said, "Then why bow?" Huangbo hit him. The novice said, "You're really too crude." Huangbo said, "What place is this we're in? Is it for idle chatter?" He then hit the novice again. This striking of students is much more accepted and respected, admired even in Asia than in the West. It's considered a little bit of a tribute to the person to strike them. And it's seldom, if ever, done in anger, or because it's not that Huangbo here was peeved with the monk. He's trying to help knock these concepts in his mind out of his mind, this concept of these notions that Huangbo was just still attached to the Buddha, and that he was beyond, the novice was beyond that. But somewhere it says that Huangbo, when he did prostrations, it was with such vigor that this spot in the center of his forehead became raised from the number of times and with what the vigor with which he did these prostrations. Here's another one. Wang Bo's teacher was another great Chan master, Bai Zhang, or his Japanese name is Yakujo. He's in the koan with the fox, Yakujo and a fox. That's Bai Zhang. So one day, Bai Zhang asked Wang Bo, "Where have you been?" Wang Bo said, "I've been picking mushrooms at the base of the mountain." Bai Zhang said, "Did you see a big tiger?" Wang Bo roared. Bai Zhang picked up an axe and assumed a pose as if to strike Wang Bo. Wang Bo then hit him. Bai Zhang laughed and returned to his room. Later, Bai Zhang entered the hall and said to the monks, "At the base of the mountain, there's a tiger. You monks should go take a look at it. Just today, I myself suffered a bite from it." And here's one about a high government official in the province where Huang Bo was. The official, this government official, by the name, his name is Pei Shan. When Pei Shan was the governing official of such and such prefecture, he built a large Zen monastery and invited Wang Bo to become abbot there. One day, Pei Shan took a figure of the Buddha, a Buddha figure, and placed it in front of Wang Bo and kneeled down and said, "I ask the master to provide me an honorific name." Now, I take this to mean provide him an honorific name for the Buddha, to which Wang Bo proclaimed, "Pei Shu." And Pei Shu responded, "Yes." Wang Bo said, "I've given you the name." And at that, Pei Shu bowed. Pei Shu is the nickname for Pei Shan. Six new students came to greet Zen Master Wang Bo. Five of the students bowed. Usually, by the way, in these koans, when they say bow, it means a prostration, not just a standing bow. Five of the students bowed, but the other student lifted his meditation cushion and drew a circle in the air with it. Huang Bo said, "I've heard that it's evil to keep a hunting dog." The monk said, "I'm chasing the sound of the wild sheep." Huang Bo said, "The sheep makes no sound for you to chase." The monk said, "Then I'll pursue the sheep by seeing its traces." Wang Bo said, "There are no traces for you to pursue." He's speaking in metaphors here. The Dharma is talking about. The monk said, "Then I will track it." Wang Bo said, "There are no tracks for you to follow." The monk said, "If that's the case, then the sheep is dead." The next day, Wang Bo addressed the monk, saying, "I want the monk who was looking for the wild sheep yesterday to come forward." The monk came forward. Wang Bo said, "The koan we discussed yesterday is not finished. After we finished speaking, what did you think?" The monk remained silent. Wang Bo said, "At first I thought you were a monk of the true teaching, but actually you're a debating instructor." Wang Bo then chased the monk out of the congregation. So that's enough biographical material. And now let's go back to the koan. Wang Bo instructing the assembly at the monastery of a great famous teacher like Wang Bo. There would have been probably hundreds of monks who would gather to hear his teaching. And this, of course, would mean vast hall, Buddha hall, that would accommodate all these monks. So I'm just sort of setting the scene as what it probably was. You do hear reports of these most famous masters of having assemblies of 1,000, even 1,500 monks. And this is what he says: "You are all mash eaters. However you go about traveling on pilgrimages, what is your position today? Do you know that in all the land of Tang there is no Zen teacher?" So this mash eaters reference, it needs a little background here. According to one source, this term, mash eaters, was used to belittle those who imitate old Zen masters. Let me first say, even further background, that it was customary in Tang Dynasty China for the monks, after spending a training period of typically it would be 90 days, after spending a period in residence at a monastery, they would then be excused and they would scatter to go around and visit other temples and other masters. And we can gather from the old texts that their motivation for going on travel like that was not always the purest. They didn't have the highest aspiration. A lot of these monks were young. So picture the last day of school. School's out. School's out. All right, let's go. And undoubtedly, they would then later report to one another that they went to see such and such a Roshi and such and such a Roshi. And there's a kind of I said earlier in Sesshin about the mentality of a collector. And there's a kind of that collecting or acquiring quality to many of these monks in their travels, just wanting to sort of add these places and these teachers to their resumes. And more than a few of these masters would comment on it, this misuse of these pilgrimages and how they were missing the whole point in going out seeking for wisdom that would be bestowed by others. Now the mash eaters used to belittle those who imitate old Zen masters. Apparently they would come back and then do just that. They would imitate what the masters had said and probably try to impress their brothers. But about the mash eating refers to the brewing process of wine after eating the mash left in the brewing process. Once the wine has been removed, they think they've had a taste of the real thing. But when actually all they've tasted is just the dregs at the bottom of the vat or whatever. So he's scolding him, of course. "You're all mash eaters. You're all missing the point. Going here and there, thinking you can find the truth outside yourselves." The epitaph of Harada Roshi, the Harada Roshi who was Roshi Kaplow's first main teacher in Japan in the 1950s, his Those words read, for 40 years I sold water by the river. You are all mash eaters. However you go about traveling on pilgrimages, what is your position today? What is your position today? What is your understanding? Do you know that in all the land of Tang, there is no Zen teacher? And then one brave monk came forward and said, but surely, oh wait, I wanted to give the context for this. This is before this. The koan, as we've read it this morning, is lifted out of a longer speech that Wang Bo gave that day. And so this is what the record reads. One day, Zen Master Wang Bo entered the hall to speak. When a very large assembly of monks had gathered, he said, "What is it that you people are all seeking here?" He then used his staff to try and drive them away, but they didn't leave. So Wang Bo returned to his seat and said, "You people," here's a different translation, "you people are all dreg slurpers." That adds another quality. If you go on a pilgrimage seeking in this way, you'll just earn people's laughter. When you see 800 or 1,000 people gathered somewhere, you just flock there. There's no telling what trouble this will cause. And then he said, "Don't you know that in all the land of Tang there is no Zen teacher?" And then a monk, a brave monk, stepped forward and said, "But surely there are those who teach disciples and lead communities. What about them?" So, stating the obvious, to which Huang Bo said, "I don't say there's no Zen. It's just that there are no Zen teachers." It's this word teacher that is so... such a misstatement. It connotes a transmitting of information, a kind of a, it's so much like instructing, as if one is doing a PowerPoint presentation. So this is how it is. It's this, it's that, it's this, it's that. There, now, have you got it? That's the way it is. It's true that in Taisho and in talk sometimes, a teacher will offer his or her understanding of things. Sometimes if it's a text or a koan or some other text, a commentary on that, offering his view of what's written there. But teaching, that the word, it just falls flat. And not just because being, not just because this process of working with students that we may call teaching, for lack of a better word, not just because sounds too much like instructing, but it's that one-way quality, as if a teacher has something that the student doesn't have. This is the fundamental problem with the word. Because it's not true. There's nothing a teacher has that the student doesn't have. Ultimately, a teacher has no more wisdom than the student. And when the teacher is teaching, so-called, it's not so much informing the student as perhaps reminding the student, you all know this Dharma. But it's not accessible in the same way as someone with experience. But somehow you know. That's why you came to the Dharma. That's why you came to practice. Why you came to Sesshin. It's because you already know it. And on some level you know there's nothing to know. A famous master, referring to his own work with his teacher, said, "Empty-handed I went to my teacher, and empty-handed I returned." It's not about learning. It's unlearning. And moreover, it's unlearning by both the student and the teacher working together. Because this is the real scam of all this, is that the teacher is getting just as much from the student as vice versa. If the teacher isn't learning from the student, or, okay, let's make it unlearning with the help of the student, then she or he isn't much of a teacher. It's a process. It's coming together and each unlearning. What does that mean? It means working with the other to lose one's notions, one's concepts. And teachers, this is working for teachers too, all the time. Another famous saying is, the practice of Zen is a practice of daily losing. I remember in my early days of teaching, when I had certain ideas, I had ideas about certain people, perhaps beginners, and the unlikelihood that they could have an awakening at a sesshin. And over the years, I kept getting surprised. And really surprised. Whether it's a beginner or a more senior person, what I had thought were the dark horses of the race, the ones who were having the most trouble, and the ones who just seemed so unwilling to let go of their notions, and then what do you know? I no longer even in the least way count anyone out, because I've been surprised so often Well, that's one kind of unlearning that I've benefited from. Of course, I knew, by virtue of my own long experience, that what we all have in common is this enlightened self-nature. And so, of course, anyone, whether you're in Sesshin or you're at a baseball game, anyone can come to awakening. But I still had thought in those early years that some people, well, it's sure, they can come to awakening, theoretically, and they will maybe someday, but not this Sesshin. No. I was wrong. It's in any case, it's not just a matter of the ability of the teacher in this awakening process. It's the student as well. You can't separate them. A teacher is granted the role of a teacher by the student. Without a student, there'd be no teacher. The two are they co-arise. The idea of a teacher being alone in the middle of the desert or the mountains doesn't make sense. It's you could call such a person a teacher, but he's not functioning as a teacher. It's the student that makes a teacher a teacher. Students. This is the law of dependent co-arising, the very heart of all of the Buddhist teaching, that no thing exists apart from every other thing. Things co-arise. The analogy that the Buddha uses for this law of dependent co-arising, he says it's like two sheaves of wheat leaning against each other in a field. Is the one supporting the other, or is it the other one supporting that one? When I think back to my years working with Roshi Kaplow, well, there are a mixture of feelings. One, there's still a thread of regret that I didn't take full opportunity of what he had to offer. As a student, it was my responsibility to look at my own role in the relationship. Just as now, it's my responsibility to look at my own role in the relationship. Anyone can find fault in the other, but that's not our work here. Of course, there were zillions of opportunities I did take advantage of. But then there are these other things, the more subtle things that got by me at the time. Things that really no one would consider teaching in any ordinary sense. Here's sort of what I'm talking about. I'm reading from the Golden Age of Zen, where if a guy who went on to become a famous master, Lungtan, his Japanese name is Ryutan, he's the one who blew out the candle as he was handing it to Deshan or Toksan, and prompted the awakening of Teshan. When Lungtan was still a young monk, he was made the attendant of his own master, and he I'll read the whole thing here. And he attended on the master with great diligence. But after some time, he went to him and he said, "Since I came, I have not received any instructions on the mind from you, master." The master replied, "Ever since you came, I have been giving you essential instructions about the mind." Now the disciple Lungtan was mystified and he said, "Hello, on what points have you instructed me?" And the master said, "Whenever you bring me tea, I take it from your hands. Whenever you serve the meal, I accept it and eat it. Whenever you bow to me, I lower my head in response. On what points have I failed to show you the essence of the mind?" About other kinds of teaching, but in spiritual teaching, the ultimate teaching is teaching by example. I've heard parents say the same thing about parenting, but this takes it far beyond the level of instruction or transmitting information. To be the teaching. Rather than being a teacher, be the teaching. Show the teaching. The way you move and respond and a million other ways. The Buddha famously said, "In my 45 years of Dharma activity, I did not preach a single word." One other Zen teacher, I forget who, may have been Suzuki Roshi, the late Suzuki Roshi, who founded the San Francisco Zen Center, said, "I just share with others what I do seriously for myself." There's also the sense of a teacher being a midwife. A teacher can't deliver the baby for the student. The student has to deliver her or his own baby, has to give birth. But a teacher can stand ready to help. But the help often is best when he just gets out of the way and lets things move along in their own course. There's a great emphasis in Zen on the practice. That's really where it happens. I see this confirmed every sesshin with people. If they'll just do the practice, or in terms of sesshin, if they just hang in there and keep at it, that's all they need. Maybe to check in now and then if they're having some question or problem that could derail them. But it's the practice is like the railroad tracks. As long as you stay on it, you'll get there. Wherever there might be. There's nowhere to go ultimately. Everything comes from the practice. It's just, again, the privilege of being a teacher, seeing day after day, seeing things just unfold in the student, and not through anything that I'm saying or doing, just their own practice, just unearthing, uncovering these riches of wisdom in themselves. As they mine ever deeper to bring these things to the surface. A teacher can just sit and look with awe at the practice. There's a famous saying in Zen, the emphasis falls on the correctness or falsity of the training, not on the excellence or mediocrity of the teaching, or the depth or shallowness of the principle. So it's not the principle, the doctrine, the ideas, certainly, not even so much the teaching, as the training, the practice, doing it. It all comes from doing it, not hearing about it, not being instructed. Doing it for oneself. And the so-called teaching is just to keep the student doing it, because that's where it all comes from. The Buddha also very famously said, "Be ye lamps unto yourselves. Seek salvation alone in the Dharma. Look not for assistance to anyone besides yourselves." All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.